This is the Home Tech Podcast Show number 60, recorded on January 26, 2012. I am your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios. Here in a very nice, I ran outside today to run in January in Nebraska with, I was in shorts. I did have a long sleeve shirt, maybe little gloves, but to be able to do that on January 26th in Nebraska is a real gift. So we are experiencing some great weather. Thank you, global warming. And of course, we post the show each week with some really good show notes done by Andrew. Although this week he is out, and I will do them out at theaverageguy.tv. You can contact the show, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. And actually, I got an email this week that I'll read on the show here shortly. And we always appreciate your comments. So you can send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Track me down on Twitter @JayCollison. And that actually, Twitter traffic has been picking up lately. So I appreciate all those folks that came out and follow. And I send out a note before the show starts. Any information about the show, you can send it that way. You can send me a direct message on Twitter too. I answer those. They come right to my phone. And so if you have a question, would like us to cover something, either one of those ways work. You can also find us on Facebook or iTunes by searching The Average Guy Podcast. And if you're on iTunes, and last week I asked if you were on iTunes to send me an email, and of course nobody did, so I'm not assuming nobody's on iTunes. I'm sure you are, but I was trying to do some feed verification. And so if you're on iTunes, just shoot me a short note either on Twitter or through an email. Just let me know how you're doing that. It'd be great to get a little bit of feedback on how you get your feed. If you're not getting this, if you've just found this podcast maybe for the first time and you like it, we've set up all the links that you need to automatically download it each week so you don't miss it. We have both iTunes and standard RSS feeds out in the right-hand column at theaverageguy.tv. All right, with us tonight, I already mentioned that Andrew is off for the night. It's Australian Day, and they're all partying like it's 1999 in Australia. The country is shut down and nothing is going on over there except good times, I am sure, but I have the Johnson family, almost. I got two of the four, right, with me tonight. And, of course, Christian joins us each week. Christian is the moderator in all things BIOS mods at bios-mods.com. And that site's rocking and rolling. Christian, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Enjoying another busy week of school and other interesting applications and such. BIOS mods is consistently adding traffic by the week. We hit some new site traffic numbers last week, and that's just continuing to climb from there. So we rolled out a new site look and site design, and we've been cleaning a lot of stuff up and getting ready to roll some new content out. So we're doing well on that front.
You know, Christian, maybe we ought to do a once a quarter, once a month podcast with you and your moderators over there and talk BIOS mods. I wonder if that would be an interesting, you know, I don't know if you could do a weekly show that way. But
yeah, I don't think you could get weekly, but I mean, there's definitely stuff to talk about.
Yeah, maybe on a weekend or so, get together you and a couple of your moderators and the developers and such. That might be interesting because, you know, a lot of that's a kind of a mystical, the BIOS is kind of a mystical thing for a lot of PC people.
Right.
And I don't, you know, now that I know you and I've kind of followed what you do and stuff, I don't think it's as difficult as you think it is to put a BIOS mod on your PC and take advantage of maybe some of the things that have been locked down by the manufacturer.
Yeah, and actually one of the new things we're working on for some of the novice end people in the BIOS world is creating a BIOS settings glossary, which explains all the settings and options in the BIOS and tells you what the recommended settings are. So that'll be rolling out pretty soon as well.
So. Yeah, very nice. Maybe someday you'll have a BIOS tuner, right, that goes in and dynamically detects what should be on and off.
Well, actually, most BIOSes now do come with either default set fail-safe default settings or set optimized performance settings. So there are profiles being written already. So
very cool. Yeah, it's kind of a mystery to a lot of people. And I think most folks are afraid that – and what language is a BIOS typically written in?
Oh, that's all in assembly language. And the newer UEFI BIOSes and EFI BIOSes are now – having some low-level C code incorporated to support things like 3 terabyte boot drives and such. So The legacy BIOS, however, is pure assembly machine language, and you'll see with UEFI, it's actually a underlying ASL code base with extensions in C that are almost like transient layers between the BIOS and the operating system. Mm. So.
Hmm. Yeah, it's still kind of a mystery to a lot of people. Christian, how did you get into BIOS? I mean, how'd you do that?
I was Googling one day on Google looking for a modified BIOS for my newly purchased refurb from HP that had they called a Nettle 2 motherboard, and it was locked down. It was the traditional HP BIOS with like two settings in it. So I was thinking, sure. I wonder if I can open this up, maybe tweak the clock settings a little bit. So I did some searching around on Google, and I found this site called BIOSmods.com. And I went there, and there were like 200 members registered and, you know, a couple posts. I said, what the heck, I'll put in a post and see what happens. So the administrator, who is actually at the time was an Australian, it changed several hands from all the way back in 2001 when it was owned by a Norwegian, and that ownership ended in 2006, and that was almost a different site in the sense that all the stuff was legacy BIOS images, and they were doing all sorts of, at that time, the modding game was completely different. It was about, you know, enabling a 64 gigabyte hard drive on a 32 gigabyte machine and that kind of stuff. So after that site phased out, it was inactive for a year or two, and then this guy picked it up, and it was just a brand new empty form, more or less. Didn't have a homepage. It was just a forms. And so I posted the Nettle 2 in there. I posted the BIOS link, and the administrator couldn't figure it out. So I sat there puttering around with what little hints I could find on the website. And then eventually I found out how to do the mod myself, and then I flashed it, and everything worked great. And so he got pretty amazed and made me moderator on the forums. And then a couple months later, he had to go on vacation for a month, so he promoted me to temporary administrator while he was on vacation.
And that was where the mistake began, right?
That was where the mistake began. After that point, he was running that site on a free, it's called X10 Hosting. He was running it on a free hosting plan because there wasn't a lot of traffic, you know, 200 registered members, sure, a couple hits a day. So yeah, why would you pay for something like that?
Right.
So when we did start getting a little bit of traffic, the site crashed for like 2 weeks. No one could get on it. And he was just, you know, eventually got to the point where it said account suspended. So he's like, oh, I don't know what to do with this. And I said, I'll make you a deal. I'll leave you on as forum administrator if you sign over all the rights to the content, and I'll host it on my own servers. So that would have been in December of 2009 when all that went over to IX Web Hosting on shared hosting. And then the rest of 2009 and 2010, we built a pretty great following, and then moved to BIOS-mods.com. We still do have a redirect to the domain without the dash, but the original Norwegian back in 2001 who owned the domain didn't want to give it up. So we pretty much drained all of the value of that old domain into the new one, and it's still just, if you type it in without the dash, it'll go to the dash, and not, there's maybe two or three people a month who still use the old domain.
Sure.
So we've gone from 200 registered users to 28,000 registered users in a year. Let's see, about a year and a half, 2 years, and we've gone over 6,800 pages and 300,000 page views a month.
Nice.
So I'd
probably say it's one of the foremost sites for help and experts in the realm of BIOS.
It's definitely number one for BIOS modifications.
Nice.
There's no other sites that are really taking modifications anymore.
Is that a Maple Grove property?
It is a Maple Grove property. Awesome. And eventually we're starting to also make sure that BIOS mods isn't just for the hardcore geek who wants to push their motherboard, but for the novice who wants to just, you know, find the OEM update and make sure everything's running okay. So that's why we've been adding stuff like the dictionary and whatnot.
Sure. Some average guy stuff. Talk to your guys, and maybe we can round up three or four of them, and you can we can do a podcast all around the BIOS, and maybe, like I said, once a month, once every other month, we can talk about the latest updates. Tim Black, Vinyl Freak, in chat had said he'd suggested that on Facebook. So, Tim, maybe I'm ripping off your idea. I think that would be very good. So talk to the guys about that, Christian, and maybe we'll do an offshoot of the Home Tech podcast and we'll do a BIOS special. Cool. Okay, thanks, Christian. Great having you on the show, as you do each and every week. Of course, Christian's dad, Gary, is with us again tonight. Gary is all things behind Christian. And
I don't know if it's that way anymore. I think it might be the other way around now.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But of course, Gary, you're the night owl who keeps the servers going there at the Johnson household, and you join us about once every 6 weeks here on the podcast. And whenever we need you to fill in, you're always there when Christian can't be. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So tonight I came home from work, and it always seems like, I don't know why Thursday nights are any different than any other night, but maybe it's because my time is a lot shorter. But I came in this evening and my monitor, I have a 24 inch monitor in the center, a 20 inch HP monitor on the left, and a really crappy Insignia monitor that I just picked up at a junk sale for a couple bucks on the right. And actually that's the best working monitor that I got, the one I paid, a few bucks for. But the Insignia one on the right wouldn't power at all, and the center 24 inch monitor was blue, like blue screen, but not the blue screen of death, just the blue screen you get on your monitor. And so I did some things, checked some connections, moved some things around, and I could not get things to work right again. I did get it to come up for a second, but it had kind of a, and I'm afraid here, guys, I'm afraid that this monitor is beginning to go, which kind of scares me.
Jim, do you have all three monitors connected to the same system?
I do. At this point, I do.
Because I've got three 24 inches on my system, and one of my monitors consistently, after like about two or three cycles of sleep, just goes dark, and you can't get to it.
Hmm.
And occasionally, what I'll do, sometimes a complete reboot will always fix it. But occasionally I can go to one of the active monitors and pull up the screen resolution settings where it shows all the monitors and what they're set at. And I can readjust that monitor that's dark and hit OK and apply the settings, and it'll bring it back. And then I revert it back to the original setting.
Sure.
And you can see it. And I have read, I tried figuring out on the internet if anybody else was having that problem. Apparently, it's a common problem with when you get to multiple monitors that they sometimes, the drivers just drop them off like they're sleeping.
Yeah.
So, you might try going into those settings and changing the settings on the resolution and seeing if it pops it back in. If not, I'll bet a complete reboot would probably bring them up.
Well, I had done a reboot. The first thing I did when I saw that is that, well, I'll just reboot it and set it to scratch, and it didn't fix it. Last week, I think this was last Sunday. So basically, this board has two onboard video ports. So it's got a HDMI, which I have an HDMI to DVI it's a DVI, and I go to HDMI into the big monitor, and then next to it's a VGA, and I come off of that and was going to the 20 inch monitor, and that was working okay. And then I put a secondary video card in it and it came off the VGA port for the really crappy monitor, and actually that worked really well until I put the SSD in. And then for some reason that configuration would no longer work. The monitors just kept really struggling. They would I couldn't get the right resolution. The big 24 inch monitor would say it was not getting a signal. I mean, it was just a mess. I did some troubleshooting for 2 hours and found nothing. Went to bed, woke up the next, as soon as I got in bed, I thought, I should have just switched those ports around, to see what happens. I didn't get out of bed. I slept. I woke up the next morning, switched around, came right back up the way it was supposed to be. And I was like, oh, great. This is awesome, right? I'm back in business. So I did nothing. I was just gone today. Right, that's it. I was out.
Did you change the video driver?
I changed nothing. Yeah, nothing. I came home and the monitors were all a mess. And of course, I knew it was going to get messy when I started this. Rennie had mentioned in chat maybe the video card, and that's a possibility. It's just a little half gig card.
you know, it's probably like one of those NVIDIA 6450s, you know, they cost $35, you know, on Newegg, one of the cheap ones that, because I really don't have much of a video. Well, I didn't at the time. You know, now we're doing the podcast and that has some video that's playing, although it's not gaming video, right?
Jim.
Yes.
Jim. 6450 is an available NVIDIA card model.
I was making that up, Christian.
6150,
okay,
however.
6150, then. Thank you for the correction. Of course he checks me on that.
You don't get away with anything when he's
on. You don't get away with a lot with Christian. So anyway, it's a pretty, it's an old half a gig video card. So just was odd. I wanted to rant just a little bit tonight and just kind of go, God, why? Maybe there were some sunspots or something today.
There were.
Were there? Maybe that's
two
it.
Two nights ago, a record Aurora Borealis and all kinds of communications disruption.
Yeah, well, maybe that's
just a
it.
A couple days ago.
I'm going to do some troubleshooting with it. I may, you know, put them on other computers just to make sure, hook it to the laptop, you know, those kinds of things, just to kind of make sure everything's up and running and working right. But any other suggestions, guys? That's Gary, you gave me a few. Christian, anything? Any other suggestions?
Does any motherboard have onboard video?
Yeah, that's the. It's got that one DVI and one VGA port.
I would try plugging each monitor individually in the DVI and see what it does.
Do I have to reboot that each time I do that, or can I just do it live? Okay.
No, we'll do it live.
Chris, any BIOS settings that would affect that?
Well, if you have an external PCI card that is your primary card, and some motherboards won't boot the onboard video card if it sees that your PCI is the first video device. So if it's not showing up in Device Manager, you may have to go into the BIOS and set the onboard video as the first boot device for video.
Okay. I've seen that before. If I have two PCI Express slots in there, which I think I do, and I wanted to just get two new video cards and put them in there, will I see a performance difference between having the video cards coming off the PCI Express slots versus the onboard video? And is that a better option than using the onboard video?
Oh, well, anything in a PCI slot is going to be inherently faster than what you get onboard. If you were to fill two graphics cards in a PCI slot and put them in SLI or Crossfire, you're effectively doubling the computing processor into one GPU, and that's even quicker.
Can I still run multiple monitors off those?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's probably just using basic cards that.
Yeah.
You would probably still get a better result with two separate PCI cards feeding each monitor as far as the speed of the graphics display.
Most of those cards have, either HDMI, DVI, or VGA. They almost always have at least two on the back of them, right? I'm assuming, yep, I can use both of those in there. Mm-hmm. So I could, in a sense, if I put two cards in, I could run four monitors.
Theoretically.
Theoretically, right. And that would be better performance than the onboard.
Should be.
Mm-hmm. All right, well. And does it really matter? I was at Best Buy the other day, and they had some NVIDIA. Christian, look up the number for me. Cheap. it was a 1 gig, the bottom of the barrel 1 gig card. For what I do, a little podcast, broadcast a little video, that should be good enough, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
Okay. All right. Well, that.
Unless you're playing Crysis on full FPS with anti-aliasing at 8x, you should be all right.
Yeah, no time for Crysis. There's too many podcasts to do. And now we launched another podcast tonight. So
yeah,
what's a guy to do when he's podcasting every night of the week? Okay.
Okay. Well, 1 gigabyte, yeah. Radeon HD 5450, $29.99.
Is that a Newegg deal?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole slew of them in here for $30.
Yeah, you got to be careful with those 5X series cards, though, because not every motherboard will boot those.
So what's the sweet spot in there? Certainly, okay, I can buy the junk, but what's the sweet spot in there? Where is it where price and value come together?
The 6000 series probably right now, because ATI is getting ready to roll out their 7X series, so they're going to be blowing out the 6X stuff. And like I have the 6950 in here, which was like a $300 card at the time. But I believe they've come down significantly in price, and they're good cards. I mean, for what you do without gaming, yeah, like here.
Oh, those will handle even gaming. That's up around $30 a piece, though. What kind of price range do you want to stay in?
Gary, what's a $50 to $75 card get me?
Yeah, there you go. Let's look here.
Christian loves power.
You can
trust you, Christian.
You can get like a Radeon 6570 for $65.
Okay.
6450s.
Probably the best one would be his 6670 1 gig for $75.
All right.
That's a good balance of performance and power.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking for, is that sweet spot.
Oh, even better, the XFX version is always preferred. The XFX 667. I've never seen that model before. 6670 is another $75 card, but you got to be careful with the 5X series Radeons, because they had some weird power settings that a lot of motherboards didn't detect until there was a BIOS update, so nothing ever really worked right. So,
didn't we run into an issue? We ran into an issue with some of these cards. You got to be careful, that actually require the PCI 2.0 Express.
Right.
Okay.
And if you don't have a 2.0 slot, some of these cards might not work. So that's the major, pitfall that you want to make sure you avoid, depending on, what your board limitations are.
I have the Gigabyte H55M USB 3. It's about a year old.
You should be fine.
That'd be 2.1.
It's about a year old.
See, the nice thing, though, about buying XFX stuff, if you get their top-line stuff, like the 6950 and the 6970, which are still going for $350, they will give you a lifetime warranty. So if the card breaks, like, could be a possible situation with your card, they will just send you a new one. Oh. Doesn't matter how old it is.
Okay.
So
You can get some of the older GeForce stuff pretty cheap, too.
Yeah, the NVIDIA GeForce, definitely. Because those... No, normally the NVIDIA GeForce, you can plug and play into anything, and it's just
that old 8800 GT that seemed to be the workhorse of the
old days. Those are still pretty good cards, though.
Yeah, what do those run, Gary? You're out there at Newegg. If I got an 8800 GT, I think that's a half a gig, so not a lot of GP, not a lot of memory on
but
there.
I mean, like, you can even go up to like a Galaxy or a Gigabit GT 430 like $60. And
Christian, do me a favor, when you're thinking about it, drop a few of those links in the show notes so I can post them out there. But yeah, so it does sound like for maybe $100, $150, I've got a few options to stop using the onboard video, and maybe it's time to upgrade that to some discrete cards. I'm pretty sure I've got two slots in there that I can use.
So what is how many cards do you have now? You have
currently?
Well, how are you powering the three monitors now?
The two come on. Well, I have one card. I have two onboard, one VGA and one DVI. And then I've got a card. See if I have a box for that anymore. I usually keep the boxes that I still have stuff with.
Yeah, I got a few boxes.
I don't see
around.
It. It's just an old half gig card that was, I bought it for $40.
So yeah, I would imagine running two monitors on your onboard is pretty demanding, especially because it's sharing the actual RAM on your computer instead of using its own memory. So
I got 8 gig in there, but. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's probably time to upgrade that video card anyways. And got some slots in there. Rennie or Tim had said in chat that he's running an ATI 5570 on his HTPC and had some good luck, didn't game on it, but had some good luck with Blu-ray, Blu-ray. Yeah,
too, Jim, you should think that rather than running $250 or $60 cards, you might be better off with one card that's a little bit more expensive but can handle all three monitors.
You got one in mind, Gary?
Well, not off the top of my head. I mean, I'd have to go through all the specs to like give you a good pick, but I'm running 3 24-inch monitors on mine at full resolution, and it's an ATI 66. What is it, Chris?
6950.
68 or 6950?
69.
One card for all three?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's a 6850.
And what are those ports? 69. Gary, what are the ports coming off?
It's got two display ports. It's got two DVIs and one HDMI.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, you know, when you get the closer you get towards that upper end, the more flexibility you get.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I've always been a utility because I don't use a lot of horsepower on my PCs. I've always just gone with what it comes with.
Here you go. The 1 gigabyte 69 or 6850s. Now these take up dual slots. These are dual wide cards, but they'd certainly drive all three of your monitors. They start at $139.
Oh, that's not bad. Right, Gary, why don't you drop that link in our show notes and I'll reference that when we put the show notes together. Yeah. So $140, that would power except I have a crappy monitor that's still running VGA. So I'd have to upgrade the monitor too.
Just get the VGA to DVI.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yep. You're right. Yeah, no, I've got plenty of those. Okay. Well. Good conversation.
In your show notes or mine?
No, in the Google. Yeah, put it under you.
Okay.
There in the Google Docs so we can reference it when I'll grab all these a little bit later and put the show notes together with them. So good stuff. It's just something I haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about. The kids both have built monster systems, gaming systems, and they SLI. Yeah, they've
Jim's
done that.
Jim's favorite term.
Yeah.
Jim, you got to look at this SLI article. What are you talking about?
I always forget what that is.
You know, NVIDIA's graphics stuff. What is SLI supposed to mean? You're going to have to send me a link. Send them the link. I still don't get it. You're gonna have to video call me and explain this.
No, it's the same as AMD's Crossfire technology. It's right. Just connecting the two GPUs on two separate cards to make you one big monster.
Yeah.
And you know where that can really become a big asset is if you do any video transcoding. If a lot of software that does transcoding now will harness the power of the GPU.
Right.
So, you know, if you got a dynamite CPU and then you throw in the processing power of a couple of heavy duty GPUs, man, that can make short work of transcoding.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I am doing some transcoding now with the video podcast portion. We've been flirting with video for a while. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. I don't put every podcast out video. Kind of depends how the podcast went and such, but we're doing more and more of that. So it would be nice to get a little more power out of the card or out of the PC with a change in card. So I have to look into that. And Tim had said in chat, it's always nice to spend Jim's money. It does seem like I get in these discussions and I end up spending cash. We on Rich's random podcast 2 weekends ago, we picked a hard drive, a solid state drive out for me. This weekend, 2 Central, 3 Eastern on Sunday, we're going to actually pick a phone for Rich. He is kind of thinking about changing over. He's leaning toward the Windows phone, but if you want to talk him out of it, you can join us right here, theaverageguy.tv/live. That's Sunday 2 Central, 3 Eastern. If you want to be a part of the conversation, just RSVP to me or send me an email and I'll get you in the hangout and we will do that live on Sunday. Hopefully I'll have this podcast out by then. I'm sure we will. So join us. Okay. I did want to mention too, just speaking of hardware, I bought this HP micro server, a month ago or so, and I had put Windows 7 on it. I had been using it to drive my Skype, what you're seeing right now, actually, not the broadcast portion of it, but the PC that's running this camera right here that I'm pointing at is now I was using that microserver, and I really bought that thing to be a Windows home server. and not, you know, not another PC. And so with the home server show, I wasn't doing enough work, you know, in the background there, testing stuff. So I pulled an old P4 off the shelf, which is just ancient. It's an old Dell 5150? Let's see. Oh, I forget now. It's an old Dell Dimension, but it's a Pentium 4 with like 2 gig of RAM in it. And it does have a SATA drive, which is probably the only reason why it's still running. Rich challenged me to throw a kilowatt meter on it, and you guys don't really want to know how much power.
Let's hear it.
It's in the hundreds. I mean, at least 100 when it's at full power. And the thing does run a little warm, although it was built pretty well, and the kids actually gamed off it for quite a while. A powerful little PC.
Is that? I occasionally get people bring me some of these old Dell XPSs to try and resurrect them. And is that one of those with like the vacuum cleaner over the CPU to try and keep it cool? Yeah, I guess those do run a little hot.
Yeah, it's got a huge sink on there.
And yeah, then it's got this big hood on it.
And
it's
all like these holes in the unit, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a RAM air induction scoop on the 1960 GTX Roadrunner.
Don't let the dog get too close. He's going to get sucked right into the...
Oh, and those things are always... They are always filled with enough lint to knit a sweater with.
Well, so I've taken this new technique, and I've talked about it on the show a couple times, where I took the PC out onto the driveway and I turned on the Leaf app. You just hit it for a second. It doesn't take very long, but you just hit it for a second, and a cloud of dust came out of this thing. I mean, just exploded. It's really cool. It's satisfying when that happens. You get all that dust out of there. And now, one of the things, someone had warned me against that. I don't know why, but they had warned me against it. I did need to go. Yeah, I did. Well, it was an old PC. I wasn't too worried about it, but I did go back and reseat it. When I first started it back up, I got the memory lights that came on, and I needed to reseat those and once I reseated them, everything worked. And it was back on. But, I don't recommend that, but it is one way to get your PC clean very, very fast. And it worked pretty well. But clean that out, and I'm going to use it now. I shut it off as soon as the podcasts are over. And it seems to be working pretty well. Video's on. It's not too bad a resolution. And so I think you can sometimes repurpose these old PCs. Gary, you got any old PCs running back there in the man cave?
Tons of them. Yeah, and it's funny. You're right. It's just a question of finding a useful purpose for an old piece of equipment that just makes your life a little bit more convenient on your network. That just solves a problem.
Right.
So yeah, you're not going to play a video game on it, but if it acts as a storage server or, communication server of some kind, or sometimes I keep an old PC. In fact, the one that Christian was talking about that he first got into the BIOS with, that's down here on my desk, and I use that as a DMZ PC, where if I want to go out on the internet and look at things that, sites that I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not they're bothersome or whatnot. Rather than risk my main system, I'll go out on that PC, and that's one that I can always just reformat really quickly if anything gets infected. So it's kind of like my test bed for anything where I'm not sure of what the environment is, and I don't want to expose my frontline equipment to. So I just use that in isolation, and bingo, I can do whatever I want to with it. But the big deal that we got some used equipment here recently off of eBay.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about that. You picked up, you sent me a little tweet and said, "Hey, what do you think of this?" And I said, "That's a pretty good deal." And what'd you pick up?
Yeah, we as you know, we're pretty heavy into the subsonic media server, which takes a lot of horsepower to do video transcoding. And so I was surfing around on eBay, and I saw this workstation. It's an HP XW8600 workstation, and it was on sale for $579, and it had $45 shipping. So altogether, it cost $6.25. And I started looking at the specs on this thing, and it just, I just said, you know, I just got to have this thing. It has two quad-core Xeon 2.83 gigahertz processors. It's got 16 gigabytes of ECC buffered RAM, and it's got two 250 gigabyte hard drives, and the hardboard has a built-in hardware LSI RAID controller. And there's six SATA ports, and there's seven SAS ports if you want to get into SAS hard drives. I says, you know, what a monster for the price. I looked at the CPUs individually. The CPUs on Amazon are selling for $300. The two hard drives I looked up on Newegg refurbished are going for $79 a piece. And then you got 16 gigabytes of ECC buffered RAM on top of it. And the case is solid steel. And Christian, what was the video card?
An NVIDIA Quadro 17,000, I believe, which is like a $150 card.
Yeah, like a full-blown workstation-type video card for doing CAD and whatnot. So I said, you know, this is the perfect foundation for a subsonic server that can transcode all the media streams and not get really bogged down. So, you know, we grabbed it, and we've got it up and running. We've got server 08R2 installed, and I do have a subsonic site on it that we're testing right now and getting all the transcoding settings set up properly and whatnot. And I had three Blu-ray streams transcoding at the same time without any one of them buffering. It's just a bear as far as horsepower goes. It's hard to bring this thing to its knees.
Nice.
So yeah, it was just a great bargain, a great steal, and it was something that really fitted a need on my network at this time. So, you know, what a great way to go.
And I think we picked that up on eBay for what, $650?
$625 with the shipping.
And we retailed all the individual parts. If we were to sell them online individually, we would have. It would have been a total of like $1,700 had we sold it individually.
Yeah, we could actually break it up and piece it out on eBay and probably double our money pretty easily.
Yeah, but it's like you said, it's a pretty good foundation server for what you're doing.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, Christian, I'm surprised you didn't make that your desktop.
Why? Because you know I love HP so much.
That's the first thing we noticed immediately is the level of quality in this workstation compared to your consumer HP product. Oh, yeah. It's like they're two different companies.
That's probably
absolutely no comparison.
Probably a year or two old, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah,
I'd think a couple of years old.
But even that, even at 2 years old. That's some pretty decent horsepower. I mean, it was way more than $500 or $625 when they bought it new.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're probably talking. I'll bet you brand new. This was close to a $10,000 system.
Yeah.
I'd have to research it. But I know that you get into the workstation category, and they're considerably higher priced than consumer products.
Yeah. So you rated those two 250 gig hard drives together for the OS?
Yeah, right now we've got them mirrored.
Okay.
So
and 250 is enough, and then what are you using for data? Do you have any data? Did you plug any more drives into it for data?
No, right now all I did was I just linked to the RAID array that we already built.
Sure.
Over the network. So it's pulling the media off the RAID array.
And you guys are using gigabit, or have you gone to a full?
Yeah. That's another feature. It had dual gigabit LANs built on board, right on the motherboard.
So you're coming out of that into what kind of router then?
Oh, that goes to my Netgear gigabit switch, 16-port gigabit switch. And
that's is that a dumb switch, or does that have some intelligence to it?
No, that's, I think, a level 2 managed.
Okay.
And then we're doing the all the DHCP assignments on the domain controller on our primary server, and then the information gets fed back to the router. You see the domain settings reflected on the router, which is the Verizon router that right. we have from Fios.
Right.
But, the other cool thing too is now that this is set up and also running Server 2008 Enterprise, we can replicate Active Directory domain services so that if one of the servers goes offline for some reason, it doesn't affect our DNS, DHCP, or login servers, which is one big thing that kind of crippled us is when we had to take our main, you know, Active Directory server offline. You lost your DNS connectivity unless you went back to the computer that you were trying to get on the internet with and manually type in, you know, Google DNS servers or whatnot, because those servers were all serving DNS internally. So now that's replicated over. It's seen as a read-only domain controller in a network, which means it can do logon and whatnot. And we also actually have Windows Home Server 2011 supports the DNS role natively. So we set up a tertiary DNS server on Windows Home Server to do that. So now we have one primary DNS zone being backed up by two other servers.
So the home server backs it up as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From a domain server.
A simple little home network.
Yeah, it's not your average guy. Your average guy setup, that's for sure. Yeah,
you know, but we started out as average guys, yeah. and I guess that's one of the reasons I point out some of these bargains that come along, because, you know, sometimes people walk into the house and they'll, you know, we'll give them an explanation of what we got going on in here, and they're going, "Oh my God, you know, how much did all this cost you?" Well, yeah, I suppose if you look back, starting in 1983, and you add up everything, it cost quite a bit. But if you realize that, you know, nothing was bought all at once, and almost everything was bought at a really good price, you know, when it was affordable, and I think that's the key today, and I've kind of alluded to this in past discussions, is that you really want to get your home networking and computing needs into a situation where you time the market by recognizing what is undervalued and being sold cheaply because inventories are high and prices are low,
right,
that you need today. So, you know, whether it be memory or video cards or SSD hard drives, and like now, because we've got enough capacity and redundancy, and I realize that, you know, hard drives are three times the price what they were 6 months ago, I'm simply not going to buy them now. So you put off buying the things that are expensive right now. You focus your purchases on the things that are really great bargains today, and then wait until the other things you need get into a market position where they're really almost like the retailers are trying to dump them because they've got too much inventory.
So what would you guys say is in that sweet spot right now? If you were to pick one or two things that are undervalued, what would you, and you were buying, what would you buy? Do you think?
Christian, a memory price is still reasonable?
Oh, yeah. Memory is a good time to buy for DDR3. 1600 is like any G-Skill DDR3 1600 kit now. You can get 8 gigs for around $100, and it's flaming fast. USB prices and flash memory has come down considerably. If you're not looking for speed, this was a Cyber Monday deal. It's a 32 gigabyte Kingston USB with 10 megabytes per second read, 5 write. So, I mean, not incredibly fast write speed, but for $10, you're getting 32 gigs of storage.
Got that for $10?
Yeah.
Nice.
Data Traveler, and that's USB 2.0.
So, did you buy local or online?
It was an online.
Okay.
And you can get higher read-write speed USBs, I believe, in fact, wherever it went. I don't know where it went. Probably down there with that. But my OCZ Rally is also a 32 gig, but when we bought that, that cost almost $70, and that was, I want to say it was, it's a little bit faster than what that Data Traveler is, but they're the same class-rated USB, and if you look at when you're purchasing USBs, it has a little class rating number in the corner. Yeah, there it is. And the class rating number determines like the overall performance of the USB, and I believe even though the Rally had a little bit of a faster read-write speed, it was the same class, so again, that's a $60 difference in a year or two. So you, any type of memory, flash memory, RAM, really good time to buy. We haven't really seen any signs of DDR4 yet, so you don't have to worry about buying all this great DDR3 and then seeing all the DDR4 motherboards and stuff coming out. That's probably still a 1 or 2 years off, I'd say, at the least. And even if you're building a budget PC and you're looking for AMD, there's a couple of AMD motherboards right now that are very reasonably priced. So if you're building Intel, you normally are going to have a higher price. But if you're going with AMD, you can normally get some budget gigabit and MSI boards that do the job well.
Go ahead, Gary.
I was going to say, be careful with these USB drive ratings and flash card speed ratings, you know, the class 2, 4, 6, 10, whatever. None of the manufacturers have the same criteria for rating them. So you really kind of, you know, to make sure you're getting the value for the money, you really want to make sure that you do some research and look at some reviews to make sure that, you know, the class rating is really valid. And there's, you know, you can get a SanDisk that's probably a class 4 that'll probably outrun an off-brand class 10. So, again, you don't strictly, you know, make a decision based on the class rating.
The class, yeah. I bought a PNY, which of course is the budget, I think, the budget bottom of the barrel memory from Best Buy. It was about $1 a gig, so, you know, it was, at the time, this was just, I don't know, maybe a month ago, 8 gig for $8. I thought, what the heck, you know, I needed an 8 gig drive, so I picked it up. You know, that thing I could not make bootable. It would not, no matter what I did, it kept erroring out. And I even used that Microsoft DVD to USB bootable tool where you can like take a Windows ISO and it's supposed to make a bootable install. And for whatever reason, it kept failing every single time. And so I ended up formatting that. The microserver has a USB 2 port right on the motherboard that you can, I just snuck that drive in there and formatted it, and it'll be a little bit of extra storage for things like drivers and such that that'll be handy. Speed isn't important there, but not all drives are made the same, I guess, is what I want to say. Quality does matter on some of those things, I would think.
Yep.
Yeah.
Back to the memory real quick. I think, so what I hear you guys saying is if you have a PC and you haven't fully maxed out and it has 2 gig or less, right? So if you're running Windows 7 and you have 2 gig or less, you should probably look at maxing out the RAM. That would be the best buy right now, is buying enough memory to max out your motherboard. Is that safe to say, or is that an overkill?
Yeah, well, no, go ahead, Christian.
It's always been the most cost affordable method for a quick upgrade, and especially because the more memory you have, even if it's not like the fastest memory speed you can get on the market, it will allow the operating system to offset a lot of the stuff it's used to caching to the hard disk, which will save you a lot of speed. And because it can dump more stuff into memory, you're just going to get faster performance, because the hard drive can never compete with a page file. Can't compete with a RAM stick.
Yeah, the thing that the typical user wants to keep in mind is that if you're running 32-bit Windows, you don't need more than 4 gigabytes of RAM. You're not going to use more than 4. But if you've got a 64-gigabit operating system, then by all means, just populate it with as much memory as the board will hold.
Yeah, it's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah. Okay. So an easy and a fairly easy upgrade, right?
Oh, yeah. Just pop open the cover and push the tabs back, pop the old ones out, push the new ones in. But usually, you know, and for people that are maybe a little bit unfamiliar or uncomfortable with it, almost every manufacturer has their manuals online. You can get it in PDF format, bring it up, and you can read through the manual, and they'll walk you through. They'll give you the exact specification of the memory you need for your system, whether it's DDR2 or DDR3, what speed specifications it's rated to run at, what the maximum memory for that motherboard is rated for. They'll show you, usually give you illustrations of how to open the case, how to pop the chips out safely, and how to seat them properly. So, like I say, it's not a terribly complicated thing to do.
And you can you can purchase RAM. I guess I didn't know this till recently. You can over purchase your RAM. In other words, you can buy faster rated memory as long as it's in the same DDR family, right? So DDR3, DDR2.
Yes.
You need to buy it that way, but if my board would support, I can overbuy. So if it only supported DDR3, let's say, what's the number, 1066, I could buy 1300 or 1600, and that should work in that board. Is that right?
Yep. Okay. You can't mix DDR2 with DDR3, so you want to make sure you identify that class first. But then once you identify whether it's DDR2 or 3, then the speed rating, if you buy a higher speed rating than what the board recommends, you should be fine.
And I just upgraded a PC this last weekend, DDR2 800, and actually I got 8 gig of that for less than $100.
Yep.
So that wasn't it's cheap even on the old stuff. You know, sometimes the price on the old stuff goes up.
That was
pretty inexpensive.
That's another thing to keep in mind when you're evaluating your memory needs and what kind of systems you have and how long you plan on keeping them, because if you wait too long, the older the memory gets after the stock and the inventory is depleted and all sold off, then they do start going up in price. And if you look at memory prices from some of the really old stuff, some of those prices are out of sight.
Yeah. You just got to be careful. It's that sweet spot, right? It's this just before they run out of inventory. You want to pick that stuff up, because as soon as it goes out of inventory, it's going to go on the market and get more expensive.
Yeah, it's the same phenomenon that we saw with the hard drives. If I'd have grabbed those 4 3-terabyte drives at $159, I'd be laughing all the way to the case right now, because they're $430 a piece.
It's crazy.
Now.
Well, hopefully they'll come back down. Okay, let's bust into Christian's corner. Christian, what do you got for us?
So, in the wonderful world of Christian's Corner, laughing at the fact that finally Google decided to allow people my age to join Google Plus. I made that little cute announcement today after the fact. So,
Christian, go ahead, Gary.
They only want mature people.
Christian, you made my Google Plus stream today. One of the guys, Michael Burris, put in there. Now Christian, it's funny because he tagged me on it. He said, now Christian can have a Google Plus account legally.
Yes. So
that was awesome.
Google.
Yeah.
Really
so, but you're already in, right?
Yeah, because I the webmaster. When I set up Google, I used to have I used to use one of my BIOS mods emails for just a personal Google account. And then when I switched over Google Apps domains to start handling the emails for all my users and whatnot, it switched over to the app domain profile. So when I logged in, it said, this account is now being managed by BIOSmods.com. You need to rename your account to a Gmail address to retain all your personal settings. So then I just switched it out to the wizbm@gmail.com. So you can email me if you want. But and that let me get back to Google Plus and everything. So
yeah, very cool. Well, it's good to have you. Good to have you on the network. And actually, as an announcement, we'll be switching full-time over to Google Plus for the podcast starting February 1st, Skype, my annual subscription for Skype group chat, which had been $75 last year, we got a 33% discount on the deal, expires on February 1st. And I'm not really all that excited about giving Microsoft another $100. So I we're going to drop group chat. Only use Skype as a backup, and that'll be an audio backup only. And we'll move everything over to Google Plus. We tested it pretty extensively during the CES coverage over at thehomeservershow.com, and it's the real deal. It's up to speed. Whatever problems they had in the beginning that we struggled with have been worked out, and we'll be making a full time. That won't affect you guys. No change as you're watching or listening to the podcast, but we'll be using Google Plus full time. So good stuff, Christian. Welcome to the world of Google Plus.
Yeah, leave it to Microsoft to charge for something that Google figured out how to do better for free.
Well, and that's, to be honest, that's an old Skype deal before Microsoft bought them. So they're just, what would have been nice is if Microsoft would have said, hey, you know what, we're just going to give you to this for free. That would have been great. I would have been like, score. But no deal. So welcome to Google, Christian. What else you got?
But does Jim know that there is a change in Google privacy policy that affects you and everyone else?
I do.
So Google is deciding that they're getting rid of their somewhat 57 individual privacy policies for each of their services and making one privacy policy for all of their services, so that by signing up for one service, you're pretty much in giving them the privacy rights for any other service you use on Google. So what that means is that they're going to start now. Normally, when you're using a Google application, it will try and pick data from how you use the application to give, you know, search results or whatnot, and customize the application based on what you're doing with it. Now that's happening across all their applications, so Google can create a complete profile. And that means stuff like one of the examples I saw on the internet was so if your Google Calendar says you have to be at this location at 8 o'clock, and you specify a location, and you have Google Location turned on your cell phone, and it sees that you're 20 miles away from the event, and you had 10 minutes to get there, you'll get a little reminder saying, you know, hey, you better hit the accelerator in the car if you're going to make it there on time. So that's why they're switching over this policy.
It'd be even better if Google was driving the car for you and it just automatically sped up.
May not be too far.
Wouldn't that be great?
Sorry we weren't able to time your schedule today. We're now going to pick it up to 80 miles per hour.
And clear the road for you, because we're talking to all the other cars that aren't in a hurry. Yeah, can you imagine how frustrating that would be if all the cars were networked together and then traffic was prioritized and you weren't the one being prioritized? You know, you're like, oh, you have time and we could pull over and you could still make it to your event on time. So we're going to pull over so the other guy can go blow him by because he's late for the airport.
Yeah.
You know, but that never work. Never work. There's a really good coverage of this, this whole debate. There had been some, when this first came out, there had been some misreporting that Google was changing their privacy for their favor and in their favor. And so if you had any questions on this, the guys over at Twig this week in Google on Laporte's network cover that very, very well. So if you're interested this week in Google, twig.tv, and they spend about an hour, I think I'm still listening to the podcast, about an hour and 20 minutes working through that deal with some folks who follow it closely. So it is a simplification of their privacy terms, which is nice.
And notice that also affects YouTube as Google.
Right.
Their privacy as well.
Right. So. You know, interestingly enough, Google is you know, with the changes in the leadership at Google, they really are becoming, you know, they used to have tons of properties that were all disconnected and not a lot of continuity or connectivity between them. And over the last year, that has radically changed, and they're really combining their services.
Mm-hmm.
And Google Plus is evidence of that.
Yeah, it brings up another topic that I thought about earlier, and many times I'm sure you recall we've talked about the public versus the private cloud, and with the takedown of Mega Upload this last week.
Right.
Oh yeah, we should talk about that.
I think that it really, really raises some valid, and I think people should just really stop and think about it for themselves, about what they're uploading to a public cloud, and whether or not they may be asked to account for their right to own what they're uploading into a public cloud. I mean, you're probably familiar with the fact that I've maintained all along that I let my cloud right down here, thank you.
You like the Johnson cloud, right?
Yeah, and I'll control security and who gets in and who knows what's here and so on and so forth. So I think that this whole thing does raise some valid concerns and some skepticism for the average user about to what extent they get involved in the public cloud and to be very, very thoughtful and careful about what content they upload to wherever it is they're involved with.
And if you go to megaupload.com now, you'll see the FBI notice that says FBI anti-piracy warning. This domain name associated with the website megaupload.com has been seized pursuant to an order issued by the U.S. District Court. A federal grand jury has indicted several individuals and entities allegedly involved in the act and related websites, charging them with the following federal crimes: conspiracy to commit racketeering, conspiracy to commit copyright infringement, conspiracy to commit money laundering, and criminal copyright infringement. So they're getting whacked with four charges.
Well, what kind of site was Mega Upload, Christian?
Before? It was kind of like a very
all pirated content.
Very grunt version of Dropbox in the sense that it was a file sharing site, not like a P2P or anything like that, but it was very well known for people just posting all sorts of copyright infringing material, and they never went in and removed it. Unlike if you were to post that on any other type of file sharing site, they have stuff that goes through and checks for copyright validity.
Yeah, and I tell you, I think it might be smart not even to type Mega Upload into your browser.
Well, I just did, and I'm there. looking at the FBI anti-piracy warning, I had not gone out there. A couple folks, six or seven arrested. The next day, in conjunction with this, the hackers, pirates went after some of the FBI, the White House, they went after some of the government sites, including Chris Dodd, who had been behind SOPA, and began to attack those sites. Took a few of them down in the process.
Yep.
And so there is a war going on. Although, well, I don't see this as – I see this as anti-piracy.
I agree, Jim, but I think you still have to ask yourself and you have to raise the question and the concerns. I mean – you know, we just had a U.S. senator detained at an airport. You know, so, you know, the power of the federal government and its reach and its ability. I mean, you know, you hear that knock on the door and or if it just gets broken in and bingo, there's the badge and we've got your IP address and we see you've been here, here, and here. There's nobody that can tell me with any certainty that, no, that doesn't happen, that, no, that'll never happen in the future. I just think you have to be very thoughtful and very careful in your surfing habits and what you upload and what content you expose that you have and who you share that information with. Like I say, the government is watching. There's no doubt. And this Justice Department and this government doesn't seem to have too much concern about pushing gray lines as far as constitutional rights go. So,
well,
you know, we're in dangerous territory.
It has been a disturbing trend, I mean, since 9/11, where the government has over... I did not want to get political on this, I'll stop right there.
But again, I think from the average user's standpoint, I think that, you know, we're all on the internet.
Right.
And we're all users, and we all look at different things. And I'm just saying that
that's good advice.
Don't be naive about asking yourself the question, is there possibly someone watching over my shoulder, and how do I think about that? And am I somewhere that I don't really want to knock on a door with somebody asking me what I was doing, where I was, and what my surfing habits are, and what I'm downloading, what I'm uploading, because I think realistically you have to accept the fact now that all of that can come under scrutiny by the federal government.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. I think it's really good advice. Christian, how does – so I'm a Dropbox user. How is – am I affected by any of this? Do I need to be concerned about what I'm uploading to Dropbox?
Right,
lots
now
of people
you're not,
use
no.
Dropbox.
No. Right now you're not. The Mega Upload for a long time has been on their list, and I think they finally got the stuff they needed to crack down on it. But Dropbox has been very reputable. So I would – stuff like Dropbox, especially in the sense that – Dropbox never had, you know, the wait 5 minutes to download, and the, you know, they made a nice clean desktop app. It was ad free, and it was just a very clean interface. So I really don't see them as being any reason people would get concerned.
Okay, and certainly, Gary, you talk about your own. You have your own private cloud. Dropbox is a feature. You know, I sent my brother, my younger brother, a text, and I know he doesn't listen to the show, so I think I'm pretty good at this point. But I said, hey, he was asking for some information, some family history information that I have really only in documents. I did this 20 years ago, and I was thinking I'll scan it in, and then I would open I'd start a folder in my Dropbox account, just call it Family Files or whatever, Collison Family Files, and I would share that with all my brothers and sisters. And then they could go in there and upload their own stuff, and it would be a great way for us to collaborate on files, and they'd always be there. They'd also always be backed up. If all five of us were on, the chances of us losing that file, because they also are loaded locally if you're using the desktop client, they'd all be backed up, right? They'd be on somebody's computer. And I said, so do you use Dropbox? And he goes, I don't even know what you're talking about. And I thought, wow, really? So there are still folks who don't know what Dropbox is, but certainly I use it a lot. We share, we do some stuff for the podcast where we share files, and I can create, you know, maybe out of 10 folders, I've got a folder that I only share with you, Christian, and I have a folder that I only share with you, Gary. And then we've got some privacy in those, between those. Gary, are you opposed to that kind of cloud-based service?
No, I don't think I'm not trying to be sound overly paranoid or suspicious, but I think you also, and I'm speaking in general terms because there's a wide range of users out there that do a lot of different things. And although I'm not too concerned about my own self and what I do, you know, there are people that probably are transmitting files and things that they probably shouldn't, maybe sharing, you know, media that they shouldn't. And so on. So I just think that whatever you're doing and however you're doing it, you should be doing it without blinders on and realizing that when you're transmitting over the internet, especially if it's not over an SSL connection, the possibility of that being monitored and looked at, maybe not right now is a very serious problem. But I think that it's coming. I think that it's going to be more pervasive if the trends continue. And I think you should just think about what you're doing and how you're doing it before you hit that send button.
Yeah, good stuff.
And again, you know, if it's your dad's birth certificate and a copy of it, it's probably not going to cause a great deal of difficulty.
Yeah, right, because that's not copyrighted
material.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, and you know, with music sharing, it seems like the kids today don't... Well, we didn't either, but the respect for copyright is questionable. And
now I think Christian isn't even the iTunes now. They've removed all the DRM from the Apple stuff, right?
Yeah.
So sure, that stuff's probably floating around.
It's all. Although, interestingly enough, if you do upload a YouTube video that has a copyrighted song on it, they'll strip that out. Now, it's a nice service. They do say, here's some music that you could choose instead. They don't charge you. At least they didn't. They don't charge you for it, which is cool. But they go, here's some free public music. And you know, for the podcasts that I do, I have been very, very careful about the music that I use for opening and closing, you know, the intro and the exit on the music, because I didn't want to run into that problem. It's really tempting to, you know, find a Van Halen song or, you know, from the 80s and use that as your opener. But then I need to get permission from the you know the artist to do that. And there actually is a whole world of royalty free permission granted music that you can download and use. And I actually found for Spartan Radio that I do, I actually found an independent artist who had his music out there, and I did send him an email and said, "Do you mind if I use it?" And he granted me permission. Actually was nice enough to grant me permission because I used it once or twice without asking him. And then I sent him an email. I said, "Hey, I'm sorry. I was out of line. I probably should have asked you first. But I've used your music in a podcast. Do you mind?" And he said, "Mind? Heck no. Send me the link to the podcast. I want to listen to it." And
The Subsonic site has a demo site, and it's all free available music. And he gives you the links to the libraries where he got that stuff. And
yeah,
you can download that stuff at any time, and there's no fee, no copyright, no big deal.
I went out and used a site, and I forget the name of it now, but I went out and found a site, and one afternoon I spent about 3 or 4 hours, and I pulled down 5 or 6 pieces of work that are all that I can use that are all available for public use. And I downloaded their licenses with them, and I put them in a folder. It's called Bumper Music. And if I ever need that in the future, I can just grab from that stash, so to speak, and I've got all the licenses with it. It didn't take long. It wasn't difficult. It's within the right realm of using fair use, the fair use policy. So if you're thinking of doing that, I don't cheat the artist. I got 2 sons that are artists, and they got to eat someday. So don't cheat the artist. Christian, anything else on Christian's Corner you want to cover?
No, I think that's a wrap.
Good stuff. Gary, anything else? We're getting to the end of our time here. Anything else that you want to cover?
Just a quick off-topic side note. Netflix. I just see in my email that they want me to come back for $7.99 a month.
And really?
I was reading on one of the sites earlier today that their revenue is off like 41% for same period year to date. Let's see if I can find that.
Yeah, it can't be too. They can't be doing too well after that announcement to split it and then and charge for both download and for.
Apparently, what it did was the download service is not doing terribly bad, but the DVD rentals have just fallen off the face of the earth.
Right.
Everybody just gave up the DVD rental, and they're shifting all to the downloads.
Maybe that's a strategic direction for them to move everybody to stream. You know, that DVD service is expensive for them. That's a very expensive feature because of the physical media. And so, you know, maybe there's some genius in this decision. We say, oh, what a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, I've read some articles to that effect that says that, you know, they did that for survival reasons, and they probably did the right thing at the right time. Yeah,
right. A good long term play. You're going to have a few quarters or maybe a year where you miss, and then it's going to come back in cost savings because you can justify the shutdown of the, you know, you shut down some distribution center. Just about every major city in the United States has a Netflix distribution center. In it, and you can, is the, you know, the need for less of those discs to be sent out, you can consolidate and save money. And so I don't know, maybe they're laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah, one last tip that I found out, anybody that owns a Kindle, you can get books free from the library. My wife downloaded a Kindle book, and when she downloaded it, you have to wait in a queue to get it from the library. They become available after someone else has read it. And then it expires in 2 weeks after you download it from the library. And apparently at the end of the 2 weeks' time, somehow Amazon works its magic and it disappears off your Kindle. But if you really haven't finished the book in 2 weeks, just turn the Wi-Fi off on your Kindle and it doesn't disappear.
Yeah, you can't communicate with the server to get delete this book message.
Yep. Yeah. So that was my.
What's
my
the
wife.
Service? What's this? How did she get to the library? What's the service? It's just available on the Kindle. How did that work?
Yeah, I'd have to actually ask her to.
Okay.
What she did, but I said you figure it out. You know, I'm tired of being the tech guru. So
nice.
So yeah, she went and
you
she downloaded.
It out.
she downloaded it, and so I said, you know, I said you ought to turn the battery or the Wi-Fi off, and that way the battery won't drain as fast. So only turn the Wi-Fi on when you're going to download something. So then she says to me, she says, you know, I talked to some of my friends, and I've had this book for more than 2 weeks, and it's still on here. And they're telling me that, no, that can't be right, that the library will pull that off of there as soon as the time is expired. And I said, must be because you got the Wi-Fi turned on.
There you go.
So,
yeah, little tip, how to hold on to it. And then, of course, you turn that Wi-Fi back on, and the book's going to go. So make sure you have indeed read it if you're doing that. You know, big burst of Kindle Fire activity right around Christmas, and then it's kind of dropped off. I haven't heard a lot about the Kindle Fire.
Yeah, actually, I was looking closer at them. I bought the base Kindle for my wife simply because I'd say, you know, let's try it, see if you like it before we spend a lot of money on something that you're not going to enjoy using. But that Kindle DX is like $400, but it's got free 3G connection.
Yeah,
so you can download a book from anywhere virtually,
right.
And it's got a nice big screen. So I do a lot of reading. So I'm looking at the Kindle, and the one thing I didn't like about it is it doesn't really handle a PDF very well on the base Kindle, and supposedly the higher scale models will take a PDF and actually format it properly for the screen for reading. So I might think about that someday. But
very cool. Yeah.
But
I got to get one someday. I don't know. I haven't done much reading, and I do when I do read, I read online. So maybe not. I could do it on my phone too.
Yeah. But I do like that liquid ink display.
Yeah.
You know that white. It almost looks like paper. And when you get into that, the DX I think is like a 9.7, so it's the size of an iPad. So, you know, it's and you know what's really nice is for reading is that it's actually lighter than a book.
Sure.
So it's easier to hold and whatnot.
Very
so
easy to read. Yeah. Very
mm-hmm.
easy to read. Yeah.
And you can store like 3,500 books on the darn thing. So that's a big advantage. But
well, if you got a Kindle Fire or any kind of Kindle device at Christmas and you've got some tips for us for how to use those. Again, that conversation kind of died off right as soon as Christmas was over, but I'm sure a ton of people got Kindles. Send us your tip podcast. Oh, and I said I was going to read that guy's email, and I was going to look that up while we were all goofing around, and I forgot to do that. Let me pull that up real quick. If you and while I'm doing that, I'll just tell you if you do want to send us your tips on that or your tip on anything or a good idea, something you'd like us to cover, send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. So Keith, and I won't use Keith's last name, but Keith sent us a note this week. He said, Jim, I've been following the Home Server Show since the beginning. Now I'm listening to the Home Tech, and I'm following Home Tech. It's amazing how you can keep on top of everything. Thanks, Keith. It's amazing how I can just do this every single week. Sometimes I wonder if I've lost my mind. Thanks for all the entertainment and education. I spend a lot of the time on the road, mostly in Colorado, and podcast and ebooks keep me sane, and I'm the same way. When I travel long distances, I use my phone and listen to podcasts. On my last trip out to my parents' place, about 10 hours out, about 8 hours podcasts. I am sick of them, though, when I get there. I'm like, I don't want to hear another podcast when I'm done. He's in the Denver area and said the next time I'm out there, maybe we can get together for coffee. So, Keith, thanks for the note. Always appreciate those. And if you've got something you'd like to get to us, some ideas, we got some of the smartest guys around helping us. You know, here we got Christian, who's the BIOS master. And if you've got some questions, Christian knows everything. Christian, is there anything you don't know?
Still getting ready for some Calc 3 next year.
Oh,
so.
Man. Well, at least we got one more year with you. Gary, any way you can keep him in high school a little bit longer? I'm afraid we're going to lose him when he goes off to college.
I'm going to build the remote workstation. Don't get too depressed.
Oh, good.
I got a feeling his dorm will be the best equipped dorm room at the school.
Yeah, probably so. So at least I don't have to think about that for another year, and we keep Christian in the hopper.
But, as long as we... as long as we can get them the bandwidth.
Yeah, well, you know, my son is down at Kansas City Art Institute. They have pretty good bandwidth down there, a pretty good plug-in. I set up a wireless router for them in the room, and they just share that, and that's a pretty good deal for them. I'm sure, Christian, I am sure at either the Ivy League or I'd like to see at Stanford. That'd be a pretty good – I think that'd be a pretty good match for you. Are you thinking about Stanford at all?
It is on my list, actually. Nice.
Okay, good. That's good. I'm sure wherever you go, it's going to have great connectivity, and you're going to be running the school by the time you leave. Just a hunch. Well, Christian, thanks for coming out tonight. Gary, always great to have you on the podcast, and I appreciate you coming out this evening. And to remind folks that, again, if they want to download the podcast automatically every week, we got all the links out there at theaverageguy.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at Jay Carlson. Christian, I always forget your Twitter. The Wiz BM, and you can follow him out there on Twitter. Andrew is off for the night. For those folks out there in chat, thanks for tuning in and hanging out with us for the evening. Next Thursday's schedule is going to be a little weird, so follow me on Twitter if you want to know exactly what time we're going live. I still haven't figured it out yet. I've got an evening event, and we may go late. We may go late on Thursday night. We may do a Friday, or we might just do it over the weekend. And then the next week, I think I'm going to be remote from Madison, Wisconsin. So we'll be doing maybe a remote podcast where I'm remote. And we'll bring everybody else in and see if we can pull that off. That's always a little scary when I do.
Are we going to do any reports on cheese?
Yes, there will be a report on cheese. Yes. Very nice. Everybody have a great evening. We'll see you back here next week. Watch for the time. And until then, have a great tech week. We'll see you next week. Good night.
All right. Night. Take care, guys. Fellow podcasters, but such is life. Hope everyone's having a good Thursday afternoon. Oh, nope, didn't want that music. Don't know where that's coming from. No idea. Where is this music coming from? I have no idea where this music is coming from.
Okay. Hi, Bert.
I have no idea where that just came from.
That wasn't from me.
I have no idea where that came from.
Maybe Jim fed that into the stream so that people would have something to listen to. I don't know.
Should only have. I don't know. Whatever. Hey guys. Hey Vinyl Freak. Jether J. Mike. Why'd you unraid, Mike?
Yeah, see, I can't see any of that stuff. I gotta undo this MVS batch file when I do this thing.
Jim?
He was there a minute ago, wasn't he?
I think so.
I thought I saw him walk in.